From January 1st, 1976, through the end of March, 1977, the Metro Detroit area was the site of 9 child murders. 3 of those cases are resolved, but the other 6 cases remain open, with most of these deaths attributed to the as-yet-unidentified Oakland County child killer. Don't Talk to Strangers is a long-form podcast focused on this series of unresolved child murders. Join us as we explore the stories of these young victims, the impact on their families and the community, and what happened to the investigation into these crimes. Subscribe to Don't Talk to Strangers on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcatcher.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. The famous quote, "Well-behaved women seldom make history," is often attributed to the likes of Eleanor Roosevelt or other noted figures. But it was actually written by historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich in 1976. That was 2 years after the death of Athalia Ponsell Lindsley, a woman who took St. Augustine, Florida by storm a few years earlier. A beautiful and interesting woman, Athalia moved from Jacksonville to St. Augustine with her ailing mother, seeking a new place to settle, and one where she had fond childhood memories. She soon found that though she might be old money, she wasn't St. Augustine old money, and that made her an outsider from the beginning. She has been called a shrew, as well as a washed-up has-been, and many other demeaning, ageist, and sexist names over the years. But she was actually quite intellectual and a feminist, though a conservative. She was also a socialite and politically ambitious, but she would not suffer fools quietly. As her widower put it, she simply had more courage than discretion. It was that outspoken courage that would lead to her brutal murder in broad daylight on the front porch of her home. She was hacked to death and nearly decapitated with a machete. And it was her reputation in St. Augustine, as well as the city's affection for her murderer, that would lead to the unimaginable miscarriage of justice that set him free. Welcome to Episode 33, An Inconvenient Woman, The Murder of Athalia Ponsell Lindsley. Founded in 1565 by Spanish explorers, St. Augustine is the oldest European-established settlement that has been continuously inhabited in the continental United States. It was 20 years before Roanoke was established in Virginia, 42 years before Jamestown, and 55 years before the Pilgrims established what is known as America's hometown in Plymouth, Massachusetts. But St. Augustine is known as the Old City, and its cobblestone streets and beautiful architecture are reminiscent of the Spanish Renaissance, as well as Italian, French, English, and colonial influences. It is a veritable multicultural mix in its beauty, if not always its actual societal classes. The founding of St. Augustine is often attributed to Spanish conquistador Ponce de Leon, who did land on the shores of Florida in 1513 and declared it La Florida, meaning land of flowers. But it's more than likely that Ponce de Leon landed near the Bridge of Lions, often called the most beautiful bridge in Dixie. It was designed as much to be a work of art as it was for transport. The lions at the head of the bridge are copies of the Medici lions found in Florence, Italy. St. Augustine was actually founded by Pedro Menendez de Viles on September 8, 1565. He named the settlement San Agustin, as his ships first spotted the land on the feast day of St. Augustine. He was also Florida's first governor. De Viles was dispatched by King Philip II of Spain to secure the coastal property he had claimed from the French Huguenots. In 1565, the race for territory in the New World, combined with the religious wars of the Reformation, sparked a massacre on the shores of Florida. Philip II saw the French as trespassers on a land that had been assigned by the Holy Church to the Spanish crown, and the Huguenots were also Protestants, and therefore heretics, violating the faith that the king had sworn to uphold. Pedro Menendez de Viles trapped the French after they were shipwrecked in a hurricane and massacred some 300 of them near a river that became known as Matanzas, which is the Spanish word for slaughter. The old city was the capital of Spanish Florida for over 200 years. It was designated as the capital of British East Florida when a colony was established there in 1763. It was ceded back to Spain shortly until Spain was finally ceded to Florida to the United States in 1819. St. Augustine was the capital of Florida until 1824 when it was moved to Tallahassee. The rich history of St. Augustine has been celebrated since the late 19th century. But even the first recorded St. Patrick's Day celebration was there when the citizens marched in a procession in March of 1601 to celebrate the feast of St. Patrick. In 1965, St. Augustine celebrated the 400th anniversary of its founding by working with the state of Florida to restore parts of the original colonial city. In 2015, the city celebrated its 450th anniversary with a festival and an official visit from Philippe VI and Queen Letizia of Spain. And every year on September 8th, the city comes alive with festival and fireworks commemorating the founding day. There are other historical moments which define St. Augustine. Florida joined the Confederacy during the Civil War, but soon Union blockades helped capture the city. Despite many residents fleeing, St. Augustine remained a deeply Southern city and culture. In 1963, the fight for civil rights came to the old city. In July, a local judge tried to force young teenagers who had been arrested for trying to order a hamburger at the whites-only lunch counter of the local Woolworths to promise that they would take part in no more demonstrations. Known as the St. Augustine Four, the teens resisted, and the judge had them first jailed, then sent to reform schools. They were released in early 1964, and that spring, civil rights leader Robert Hayling and Dr. Martin Luther King came to St. Augustine. They organized marches, sit-ins, and other forms of peaceful protest. St. Augustine became notorious for being the only Florida city Dr. King was arrested in. The Ku Klux Klan reacted to the peaceful protests with violent attacks, which drew national and international media attention. The revulsion felt almost nationwide against the Klan helped finally generate national sympathy, and many believe the violence in St. Augustine is a key factor in the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. 10 years later, when Athalia Ponzell Lindsley was murdered, things may have legally changed, but the racist and classist culture of St. Augustine was alive and well. And we may as well go ahead and add sexist to that description. Women certainly weren't leaders. They were supposed to stay home and take care of family. Even though this was the peak of the second wave of feminism, St. Augustine was an old city, with old money, set in its old ways. Athalia Ann Fetter was born in Cuba, though her official birthplace is listed as Toledo, Ohio. Her mother, Margarita, may have flown to the States to give birth to make sure her daughter had no future citizenship issues, but we don't know that for sure. The Fetters lived on the Isle of Pines, known as Isla La Juventud, or the Isle of Youth today. It is Cuban-controlled, though it was initially owned by America. Margarita flew there from Miami for vacation when she met Athalia's father, Charles Fetter. Much like her daughter, Margarita was a vibrant and adventurous woman. She met her match with Charles, who was considered a pioneer and colonist, and owned a chain of stores on the Isle of Pines. He and Margarita married in July of 1916, and Athalia was born a little over 1 year later. She spent her first 9 years on the island known for its forests of pine trees and balmy breezes from the Caribbean Sea. Her sister Geraldine was born there 2 years after Athalia. In 1926, anti-American sentiment on the island was reaching a fever pitch despite all of Charles's good work. He was convicted of sedition, which is speech meant to incite a rebellion, but was pardoned and released, on the contingent that the family left the island. They moved to a mansion in the posh Riverside area in Jacksonville, Florida, where Athalia and her sister both grew up and finished high school. Athalia married at age 18, but it only lasted a couple of years. Not long after that, in 1937, she and Geraldine moved to New York City. They shared an apartment and lived quite the bohemian lifestyle, mixing with people of all nationalities, races, and social standing. They both dropped Fetter and adopted Poncel as their surname, and they both tried modeling, acting, singing, and dancing, hoping to make it big. Athalia showed much more promise for success. She was tall, blonde, and thin, with beautiful high cheekbones and a gorgeous smile. She was a Powers model, featured in shampoo and toothpaste ads, even making Life magazine. She was also a chorus girl and sang on Broadway in a musical that ran for a few weeks before becoming a regular on a game show called Winner Takes All. Athalia's love life in New York was juicy gossip fodder for the newspapers. She dated many prominent men in the city, most notably Joseph Kennedy Jr., until his death during World War II. She was often rumored to be engaged to this man or that, but she didn't marry, and by the time she was 30, the modeling gigs dried up. Not that it's easy for women of a certain age now, but back then, models past their 20s were discarded very quickly. So in 1947, she returned to Jacksonville, living in her parents' mansion. She met and married a real estate agent named Charles Bloom, but had no children of her own, and they divorced in 1962. By then, her sister Geraldine had moved to Hawaii, and married and had children. When their mother became ill, Athalia became her caretaker for the rest of her life. She worked when she could, selling real estate, and took college courses, though she never earned a degree. It's likely her constant care for her mother stymied her own career, but she was always trying new things and loved being involved in the community. She ran for public office once and joined all the clubs her mother had belonged to, like the Daughters of the American Revolution. She had the right pedigree in Jacksonville and did well there. She wrote a book on gardening and even patented a kitchen pot cleaning device. For whatever reason, after years of living in the Riverside Mansion in Jacksonville, Athalia decided it was time for a change. She had lovely childhood memories of St. Augustine and decided that's where she and Margarita would move. In 1971, they sold the Riverside Mansion and bought a Spanish-style mansion on Marine Street in St. Augustine. With beautiful natural light in the home and a large fenced-in yard, Athalia, her mother, and their pets settled in. And almost from the moment of her arrival, she was in a constant feud with her neighbors over her 7 dogs. Athalia was fairly shocked at the reception she received in St. Augustine. She was a popular socialite in Jacksonville and well-loved by her friends. She enjoyed none of the southern hospitality she had grown up with and that the region is so famous for. But I think it may have been more than the dogs. I think her neighbors just saw her as an outsider. Despite her years in Jacksonville, she was still seen as a snooty New York Yankee. But more than that, she was simply an opinionated, intelligent woman who wasn't afraid to speak her mind. The dogs were just a button to push, a way to bully, but her barking dogs became a huge issue with her neighbors on either side, the McCormicks and the Stanfords. The issue with her dogs seems especially petty considering that Marine Street was a busy thoroughfare in St. Augustine, with a hospital on one end ensuring the sound of sirens at all hours of the day, along with heavy traffic. Really, how bad could the barking dogs have been? One of them was a very elderly small dog that was Athalia's mother's pet. Consider the fact that she was taking care of her very ill mother and was home pretty much 24 hours a day. And these pets were beloved, not chained up outdoors all day. Interestingly, on the day of her murder, no one heard a peep out of her so-called nuisance dogs. And it was the wives who led the charge, Rosemary McCormick and Patty Stanford. Before the drama with the dogs started, the ladies had already been making fun of Athalia wearing a pink robe in the yard as she took her dogs out or tended to her flowers. The rancor these women showed would almost look like jealousy if it weren't for their age difference. Athalia was a single woman in her early 50s when this started, and those ladies were in their early 40s, married to successful men with children and beautiful homes. But it must be said that Athalia remained a beautiful woman into her 50s. And I would surmise that they could have been jealous of her supposed independence, though Athalia was definitely tied down taking care of her mother. But perhaps it was just her otherness, that nameless quality that brings out the worst in bullies. And unfortunately for Athalia, her neighbors had well documented their grievances with her pets. They took her to court, and she was convicted of disturbing the peace and fined $50. She didn't show up for court, probably because she was home with her mother that day. Because she certainly fought with her neighbors hard for the rest of her life. After this, she boarded all but three of her dogs, but her neighbors remained incensed. Rosemary McCormick managed to get a warrant for her arrest sworn just 3 days before Athalia's mother died. Patty Sanford didn't show up for court this time, but wrote a long letter with her complaints to the judge, claiming, quote, "I feel like I'm in the middle of a nightmare." Margarita Fetter passed away on April 26, 1973, but her daughter's neighbors did not stop their onslaught of harassment in respect for her grief. Athalia buried her mother and got on with her life in St. Augustine. She still dabbled in real estate, and in 1973, she met another realtor, former mayor and county commissioner James Lindsley. His nickname was Jinx, supposedly because his first wife died in a car accident and his son in a motorcycle accident, but to me that seems a heartless nickname. Hopefully it meant something else, but nicknames in the South always fail to shock me. He was 62, and his wife had only died 2 years before, but he and Athalia married after dating for only 4 months. St. Augustine folks found their marriage odd. They remained in separate residences. Perhaps Athalia liked her own place, but records also showed that the couple were trying to sell the mansion on Marine Street. But regardless, she remained there while Jinx stayed at the historic Lindsley House on George Street. Maybe it was to guard the house and her mother's prized possessions. Maybe it was to stand her ground with her antagonistic neighbors. But though later it came out that there were some problems with her new marriage, most friends characterized them as loving and affectionate. After her first court battle with her neighbors, Athalia hired a tree surgeon to cut back two trees on the property line between her house and the Stanfords. If they were pissed at Athalia before, this just escalated things. Patty complained when Athalia planted 10-foot-high bamboo at the corner of the Stanfords' driveway. She managed to get the city to remove the bamboo, deeming it a visual obstruction. Even though it was Patty who started this particular spat, Athalia went after the McCormicks, particularly Colonel McCormick, Rosemary's husband, writing a letter to his commanding officer. There is no record of this letter, but most assume it was a formal complaint of some sort. But the letter was ignored, and Athalia turned her attention to Alan Stanford, Patty's husband. Alan Stanford Jr. happened to be the county manager and therefore a much better target. If you find it strange that Athalia focused her vengeance on the husbands, you're not alone. It was most certainly Rosemary and Patty who were constantly stirring up shit for her. But we can't really know why, for many reasons, most of which is that we only have one side of the story. Athalia is dead and cannot defend herself. We don't know everything that may have gone on, no matter how public their feud was. My thoughts on this is that there wasn't much she could do to the women. They had no careers to destroy, their social standing was never in question, and in fact probably went higher for their bullying stance on Athalia, who was viewed as an outsider from the moment she arrived. But author Elizabeth Randall, who wrote Murder in St. Augustine, The Mysterious Death of Athalia Ponzell Lindsley, has another theory that makes a lot of sense. Athalia had been through a lot in those 3 years since the move from Jacksonville. We're not even really sure of her motive for moving. Add to that the constant care her mother needed, a woman who was so ill she couldn't even go to the bathroom alone. And when her mother died, Athalia lost a huge part of what defined her adult life. And then she went through a whirlwind courtship and marriage that wasn't perfect by many standards. But friends and family also say Athalia didn't look well. Her sister Geraldine said she was run down, so thin she was gaunt. One friend, who we will talk about later, said that she was often nervous and distraught. And after her death, though Athalia had been through menopause, there was a used tampon with huge blood clots found in her bathroom garbage. This could indicate something like uterine or cervical cancer. She could have been a very ill woman, which might have affected her mental state. Personally, I think it was a combination of things. Though Rosemary and Patty had the power to torment Athalia, she could do little to really get back at them. So she went for their husbands, more specifically, Patty's husband. But as her agenda towards Alan Stanford grew, her reputation in St. Augustine got even worse. She was seen as manic and obsessed with bringing the man down. This went beyond the fight over barking dogs and trees on property lines. It was personal towards him. And again, maybe we're missing a piece of this, and certainly, Alan Stanford was no saint. A lot of Athalia's accusations were spot on, especially when it came to the conditions of St. John's County roads. And when James Jinx Lindsley, city commissioner, introduced his wife to the rest of the council, he agreed with her concerns. And there were a lot of complaints from ordinary citizens about Alan Stanford's work ethic. Though Athalia took the brunt of most of the bad press, there was at least one headline from the St. Augustine Record that read, "Hooray for Mrs. Lindsley." There was talk about Stanford cutting corners and rerouting funds, and even accusations of him taking materials home for his own projects. He also enjoyed a paycheck more than double that of any other county employee. He may have been the manager, but his salary was still pretty extraordinary in comparison. But the other thing about Alan Stanford is that while many public officials face public criticism, most don't rise to the bait. Well, at least in that era. You can't compare it to our 24-hour news cycle with scandals literally in our hands on our phones the minute they go public. But in 1973, it was unseemly for a public official to get into a public feud with a citizen, especially the wife of a former mayor and city commissioner. Alan Stanford seemed just as spiteful and vengeful, if not more so, than Athalia was. Though he was often portrayed in the papers as calm and composed, there are plenty of other stories about his temper and pettiness. His office had a 150% turnover rate. That's pretty astounding. It was often joked that at county commission meetings, heads would roll. That joke would later become extremely morbid and prophetic. But really, it would seem that as usual, the rumor mill works whichever way you want it to. Meaning, whose side are you on? The papers and most of the community sided with Alan Stanford. The former frat boy from Atlanta, with his beautiful Southern Belle wife, fit right in with the upper echelon of society in St. Augustine. Not long after the death of her mother, Athalia invited a group of friends from Jacksonville to her home for a small party. As they were leaving and she stood in the drive waving goodbye, Alan Stanford pulled into the driveway next door and gestured to Athalia to come talk to him. She said that he told her, quote, "You're a vicious and evil woman, and one day I'm going to fix you." At this time, I'm going to pause to hear a word from one of our sponsors. At ModCloth, there's no such thing as an ordinary outfit. They want us to be fearless in what we want, to go against the current and be unapologetically ourselves. Crafted by a team of in-house designers, their signature styles include hand-drawn prints, standout silhouettes, and an inclusive size range that celebrates all women. Fall is in full swing at ModCloth. If you're not already curled up in a sweater, they've got you covered with cozy essentials and cute knits that just won't quit. ModCloth believes fashion should celebrate all women. That's why they offer a full range of sizes from double extra smalls to 4X and plus sizes. I loved that when I first checked out their website, a plus size model was featured right next to a size 0. All sizes and all body types are featured equally, and that is so refreshing. And if you've got a question about fit, their team of mod stylists can hook you up with complimentary sizing and styling help. I also can't wait to try out their holiday gift guide with unique finds and all prices. You'll be able to take care of everyone on your list, including yourself. To get 15% off your first purchase of $100 or more, go to modcloth.com and enter code SOUTHERNFRIED at checkout. This offer is valid for one-time use only and expires February 2nd, 2019. Once again, to get 15% off your first purchase over $100, that is modcloth.com, and enter code SOUTHERNFRIED at checkout. Offer valid for one time only and expires February 2nd, 2019. And now, back to the show. Athalia Ponsell Lindsley was not the sort of woman to take a threat like Alan gave her in stride. She told several friends and colleagues of her husband's about the threat. I didn't find record of her making a formal complaint to the police, and I can't really imagine why she didn't, except that she knew she had no proof. It was he said, she said, and the cops probably couldn't do anything. So she took it public. She showed up at a public county commission meeting and repeated what he had said, but it was struck from the official minutes of the meeting. It was added as an addendum after her death by a deputy clerk, but by then, that addition would look suspicious even if witnesses verified it. But the meeting in question was in October of 1973, and it was a particularly heated one. Athalia's main line of attack on Alan Stanford was his lack of credentials. One of the requirements of a county manager was an engineering degree. But while Alan Stanford did have a degree, he had failed the state board exams to become a civil engineer. And he fudged on his application and resume, claiming all sorts of expertise in areas of engineering without actually specifying that he held the proper degree. Athalia seized on this and railed to the commission in a public meeting, quote, "You're pouring taxpayer money down a rat hole." Alan Stanford was making $20,000 a year. That's almost $100,000 in 2018 money. And his subordinates were making $6,000 to $8,000 a year. They had recently all received an 11% raise, but Stanford's was significantly higher. Chairman of the board and Alan Stanford's close friend, Herbie Wiles, spoke up and said, quote, "Well, we feel like, I mean, I personally, Mrs. Lindsley, feel like he's worth it." He went on to deny that a civil engineering degree was a condition of Stanford's employment as county manager, which was an outright lie, as Athalia discovered when she wrote the executive director of the Florida Department of Professional and Occupational Regulations that December. She wrote, quote, "We feel it our duty to inform the apparent malpractice of a man who appears to be passing himself off as a certified engineer. He signs county legal documents as the county engineer when, as far as we can ascertain, he has no engineering degree in any field. The seeming chicanery casts a shadow on the Professional Engineering Society of the state of Florida, comparable to a quack practicing medicine. By bringing this to your attention, we hope it can be investigated and rectified." She got an answer from Executive Director J.Y. Reed, who wrote back and claimed that Alan Stanford was planning to retake the engineering examination in April. So clearly this was a requirement. The board was just complicit in letting Alan Stanford get away with this deficit on his resume. At another public commission meeting, Athalia accused Alan of putting sugar in her gas tank while she was out of town with Jinx. James Jinx Lindsley was suspicious enough himself to confront Alan Stanford, who happened to be working on the roof of his house at the time, so it didn't come to a physical confrontation. On January 22nd, the day before her murder, Athalia attended another commission meeting. This time, she had been interviewing current and ex-employees of the county manager. Of course, many ex-employees would not view their former boss favorably, but the current employees willing to come forward really lent credence to Athalia's accusations. The county roads were a mess with potholes and flooding. Residents in the area were also complaining to the Department of Pollution Control because garbage trucks were dumping in areas supposedly to enrich the soil, but the stench was terrible. It was meant to be a landfill, but wasn't designed properly. County employee Clyde Woolever showed up in support of Athalia at the same meeting on the 22nd. He called road conditions deplorable and specifically noted design issues on Ashton Road, which was only an inch thick, as opposed to the 6 to 8 inches it should have been if designed by engineers. Alan Stanford, who held no civil engineering degree, signed off on that debacle as well. Alan tried to answer and say the road was 4 inches thick, but minutes from a November meeting proved that he had already said it was only 2 inches. Say what you will about Athalia's vendetta or her techniques, but I don't think any honest person could say that she was totally wrong about Alan. He clearly wasn't qualified to make these decisions. The next day, Alan fired Clyde Woolover, though he later insisted it had nothing to do with his support of Athalia. He fired him literally the day after. How exactly did he think this would look, especially in light of his reputation for employee turnover? A little after 4 o'clock the next day, January 23, 1974, the day of Athalia's murder, two investigators, Thomas Murphy and Elmer Emmerich from the Florida State Board, showed up unannounced at Alan's office concerning that letter Athalia had written. They came to discuss Athalia's letter and investigate Alan's credentials. Mr. Emmerich later testified that Alan remained calm and collected during the meeting, showing the normal concern anyone would feel in that situation. He added, quote, "Mr. Stanford did not give any indication that would lead me to believe that he would go out and kill Mrs. Lindsley." Despite Emmerich's statement, he and Murphy did inform Alan Stanford that he was violating Florida state law by misrepresenting his public position. Alan did his best to deflect these problems by explaining his feud with Athalia and her single-minded mission to get him fired. He actually thought that having a good old boy talk with these officials about his shrew of a neighbor might get him off the hook. Mr. Murphy wasn't as neutral in his own statement about Alan's conduct at that meeting. He said, quote, I would have been upset and angered at such an interview, and I felt that Stanford was just too cool for the situation. The meeting lasted for about an hour, and after the men left at 5:15, they decided to drive down Marine Street to find where Athalia and the Stanfords lived. They planned to come speak with her the following day to get her side of the story. Both of them agreed that the time was 5:30 p.m. and the street was fairly quiet. They didn't see Athalia or her neighbors and went on to the Holiday Inn where they were staying to see about dinner. On January 23rd, Athalia and her husband had spent the day in Jacksonville shopping. They had a weekly date where he took off work and they went to Jacksonville for lunch, shopping, or whatever, just a small escape. This is why, no matter the small whispers about their new marriage, I do believe they cared about each other, and Jinx should never have been a viable suspect. Sure, they were unconventional. They lived in separate homes, but probably for financial reasons rather than gossipy marriage reasons. But from all accounts, Jinx Lindsley was completely besotted with his wife. Athalia's one good friend in St. Augustine, Frances Bemis, characterized their relationship as affectionate and loving. Another interesting thing about this case is that Frances Bemis was found murdered less than a year after her friend. She was literally beaten to death, probably with a rock or brick, while out walking her dog. Unlike Athalia, she was well-liked in the community and had no enemies, and no one could figure out a motive for her murder. Her case remains unsolved to this day, but rumor has it, notes were found in her home to indicate she planned to write a book on her friend's murder. Perhaps someone didn't want those details in a scandalous book. The local papers were one thing, but a true crime novel could become a national bestseller, and that changes things quite a bit. But back to the timeline. On the afternoon of January 23rd, Athalia was seen leaving Jinx's office at around 5:35 p.m. She and her husband had plans to celebrate the Chinese New Year that evening, and she was just returning home to see to her animals. Jinx went on to run errands for their evening, making several stops. He was seen by no less than 7 witnesses. Specifically, his neighbor saw him at 6:05 p.m. There is no way he could have gotten home from murdering his wife in that record time. Furthermore, even though they are not admitted in court and modern investigators find them unreliable, for what it's worth, James Jinx Lindsley passed a polygraph. Jinx later said, quote, It's a terrible, terrible thing, not only to have such a grievous loss, but also to have these invisible fingers of suspicion pointing at you. At least this has taken some of the weight off my mind, although it doesn't take any of the sorrow away. At 6:08 p.m., Locke McCormick, son of Rosemary McCormick, one of the original instigators of the feud, called the police and ambulance. He was 18 years old and home for college, and would be the only eyewitness to come forward. He told the first officers on the scene that he was on the couch and heard what sounded like loud snapping or like hands clapping. He looked out the window directly at Athalia's front porch and saw a man in dark pants and a white dress shirt standing there with his back to him. He ran outside and said he could see the man's shoulder moving up and down like he was swinging an object. Then the clapping sound stopped, and the man walked slowly away from Athalia's home towards the southwest corner of her yard, which would have been in the direction of the Stanford home. When he took a few more steps towards her porch, he saw Athalia's body and started shouting at his mother to call the police and ambulance. What was left out of the official police report is what he originally told the first officer on scene, that he had shouted to his mother, Mr. Stanford was hitting Mrs. Poncel. Athalia was lying sprawled on the front steps with blood splashed all around her, even up on the walls of her home. Her head was hanging by one thin tissue of her neck. Her body was mainly down at the bottom of the steps, with her dress hitched up and her pearls scattered all over in the blood pooling on the sidewalk. She had defensive wounds to her arms and even severed fingers. It was a vicious attack. The medical examiner, Dr. Arthur Schwartz, said her cause of death was almost complete decapitation. Quote, One single clean blow from the back of the head down through the skull and neck bone and through the main artery was the main cause of death. He said at trial that she most definitely was attacked with a machete, as it was the only weapon that could come close to making that sort of injury in one clean hit. This murder weapon might sound odd to some of us, but not to Floridians. Machetes are commonly used for hacking palm trees and other brush in yards. Everyone had one. Interestingly, Alan Stanford had actually checked one out from the county supply. He claimed he had returned it, but there was no record of that. The first two officers on the scene were met by two ambulance attendants who arrived at the same time. Athalia's body had been covered by a white sheet that had already turned a deep red. They found no murder weapon, and when they entered her home, they found her grocery bag on the floor, not spilled, and her back door was closed, but the keys were still in it, as if she was interrupted by a knock or doorbell ring from her front door. The St. Augustine Records staff photographer later said that the scene was a chaotic mess. He said officers were walking through everything and destroying the crime scene. He said there was blood all over the grass, and it led around to the south side of the house, towards the Stanford home. He even said that one of the officers ordered an ambulance attendant to hose down the front steps, washing away the blood. Naturally, that created gossip that the police were covering up for someone, and most thought it was James Jinks Lindsley. Though Jinks was part of the good old boy club, I'm not sure this is why. The St. Augustine police had no forensic investigators. There was no CSI. To our modern minds, the recklessness at the scene is unimaginable. But look at it with 1974 eyes, and it makes more sense. These police didn't know better. The neighborhood was hysterical. There had never been a murder like this before in St. Augustine. I think all they were trying to do was stop the looky-loos and get on with the investigation. The crime scene photos had already been taken. At 7 o'clock, Alan Stanford pulled into his driveway next door. He approached a police officer and said, "Was she shot or was she cut?" That sounds suspicious to me through a 1974 or 2018 lens, but I suppose just by the nature of the bloody body on her porch, it might have not been that strange. There is no notation of what time they actually removed her body from the scene, nor when it was hosed down, but I guess in Alan's mind, just walking into his house without talking to the police would have looked stranger. For the sheriff and the officers working the case, there were only ever two suspects. Whether or not anyone ever really suspected Jinks is up for debate. I think not, no matter how much public favor was in Alan's corner. The truth of the matter is, Alan had motive, means, and opportunity. By his own admission, he came home after the meeting with the men from the Florida State Board. He said he threw on some old work clothes, and then he even admitted he fixed a gin and tonic and chugged it standing in his kitchen sink. He knew at this point that he was screwed. That tomorrow, those fellas from the state board would be talking to Athalia. As vicious and ugly as their feud was, you can only imagine his rage at knowing that she had finally won. He was about to lose his job. But back to his supposed timeline, he insists that he got back in his car and drove to the office to pick up some book and a slide rule for paperwork to do at home. Logistically speaking, he literally would have passed the men he had that meeting with. They did not report seeing him. He claims he left the house by no later than 5:40 and was back at his office by 5:50. He would later claim that five people saw him there, but it was bullshit. He could never produce these witnesses. I do think Alan went to his office after he butchered Athalia. There were bloodstains found on a pole near where Alan parked his car. He had calmly walked to his garage, changed into his work clothes, took off his wristwatch, and wrapped the machete in an old baby diaper, and then flew out of his driveway before other witnesses knew what was happening. He then ditched the murder weapon and his other bloody items before going back to his office to create an alibi. The machete and the clothes Alan was wearing were found after the police announced a $500 reward for the murder weapon. Dewey Lee was a town drunk, but he was also a combat vet on disability who loved and supported his kids as best he could, which meant he scavenged junkyards for parts to sell all the time. He jumped at the chance for the reward and spent 2 weeks searching. He eventually found the machete, wrapped in a baby diaper, and the clothes and watch Alan had worn. They were in a marshy spot less than a mile from the river, within 3 miles from Marine Street. The serial number on the wristwatch was matched to the jeweler who had not only sold the watch to Alan Stanford, but had recently repaired it for him. That's a positive ID. Officers even tracked down the department store where Patty Stanford had bought her husband's pants and shirt. The sizes matched perfectly, and he even had a credit card receipt on file. Also, to explain the baby diaper, Patty and Alan had a toddler-aged child who would recently have been in diapers. From Elizabeth Randall's book, I got the hint that the child might actually have been their granddaughter, perhaps the illegitimate child of Patricia. But regardless, on that diaper, aside from the blood stains, were paint stains. So it was an old baby diaper, used for housework, laying in Alan's garage. Officers then even traced the paint to a Sherwin-Williams store where Allen had purchased those exact colors with a credit card the year before. Other than Locke McCormick, who was obviously intimidated into changing his story, the only real witnesses were his daughter and wife, Patty, and his daughter Patricia, who was 18 and home at the time, and they kept changing their stories. I won't even bother going through all the things they claimed and then denied. They are not reliable witnesses, particularly Patty, who in my opinion had her own agenda anyway. No one can place him at his office at 6 o'clock. In fact, one county employee specifically said he was at the office between 5:30 and 6 p.m. and never saw Allen's car. Locke McCormick called the police at exactly 6:08 after witnessing the murder, although he may not have fully understood what he was seeing until after. The point is, there was only one man in town who had it out for Athalia Poncel Lindsley, and everyone knew it. At this time, I'm going to pause for a final word from our sponsors. On February 22, 1974, almost a month to the day of Athalia's murder, Allen Stanford was arrested at his home. He smiled broadly for reporters and photographers, and the next day's headlines showed that and announced that he had been granted bail for $20,000. A smaller but prominent headline within the story quoted Allen as saying, "Five witnesses saw me at the office." As Allen sat in jail over the weekend, Patty got her father to write a check for Allen's bail. At his bond hearing on Monday morning, the judge, who is the same judge that sent the St. Augustine Four, the black teens, to jail, said he preferred not to assign bond. So Allen skipped out of jail into his wife's loving arms to await trial. I would like to point out that while the town was firmly in Allen's corner and Athalia was a veritable pariah, the sheriff and his officers investigated this case exhaustively. They may not have had the forensic training, but they knew how to hit the pavement, question witnesses, find missing evidence. They weren't exactly the Keystone Cops you might imagine. They also had no particular bias either way towards Allen Stanford. He was and is the only suspect ever named in Athalia's murder. Even after Allen was acquitted, they declined to reopen the investigation because they were certain they had their man. And why wouldn't they? They had Allen's clothes, the watch, and the murder weapon, which had blonde hair stuck in blood on it that matched Athalia's hair. They had Athalia's public accusation of Allen's death threat. They had a highly public and gossiped about feud with Allen and Patty Stanford, though it would appear the McCormicks were out of it by now, except for their son Locke changing his story. But Patty Stanford and her father knew they needed a big gun to defend Allen, and they hired a man named Walter Arnold Jr. from Jacksonville, a renowned criminal defense attorney. Again, Allen didn't have the cash for the retainer, and this time his father-in-law didn't pony up. You know who did? A man named Perry Mullen, who was an editor, reporter, and executive for the Associated Press. Talk about a conflict of interest. Local papers were bad enough, but even an executive from the Associated Press was in Allen's corner. But beyond the retainer, the Stanfords still had to live until trial, and Allen had been suspended without pay until the trial was over. Incredibly, the church the family attended actually passed around the collection plate to help Allen Stanford and his family. Trinity Episcopal was notorious for refusing to integrate in the 1960s, and when they were forced to integrate, they were so unwelcoming of any African Americans that none attended their church. If this is shocking to you, that a church would raise money for an alleged murderer rather than his victim, you're right. And the whole congregation wasn't behind it either. Pastor Michael Boss received heavy criticism for this decision, and James Jinks Lindsley was very public about his opinion on this, saying, quote, "He thinks it more proper to pray for the wolf than for the slaughtered lamb." Allen's defense attorney was a bulldog and immediately filed a bunch of motions, first and foremost to have the indictment thrown out. He lost this motion, but he won other crucial motions that cost the prosecution dearly. First, in an unusual stance, Assistant DA Richard Watson asked for a change of venue. This is really interesting because it's usually the defense that wants the trial moved due to pretrial publicity. This just goes to show how aware police and prosecutors were of Athalia and Allen's respective reputations in town. It was a popularity contest, not a trial, and they knew it. Watson lost that motion, and the trial stayed in St. John's County, in St. Augustine, right in the heart of the community that knew the ins and outs of this feud and had fervently taken sides. The other critical motion that Watson lost was Arnold's motion to suppress the evidence taken from Allen's home, though there was a search warrant. What they found were the other work clothes Allen had on that day, along with a shovel, a blood-stained napkin, and two bloody concrete blocks. These were all found in the garage. Arnold argued that the search warrant was not specific to the rooms to be searched and therefore violated Allen's constitutional rights. No, the warrant did not go room by room, but asking for bloody clothing and other blood-stained items is normally sufficient. But a new judge, with only a year's experience, was overseeing the trial and was intimidated by Walter Arnold. He threw the evidence out. The trial records are missing. What can be gleaned is by newspapers and witnesses who attended, and there were plenty. They actually sold tickets for spectators. The medical examiner did a fine job on the stand, as did some of the officers, particularly one that described the blood trail from Athalia's porch through their yards right to the center of a wall that divided the two properties. Clearly, Allen jumped this wall and ran to his garage. Walter Arnold naturally argued that this was due to crime scene contamination by the police. He also did his very best to point his finger at James Lindsley. Geraldine, Athalia's sister, had unfortunately reported that her sister said he was a thief and a liar. Perhaps there were troubles in the marriage, but as a sister, I can tell you, when angry, we call each other and say many things we may not really mean in the heat of the moment. But Jinx did contest Athalia's will, forcing Geraldine to split the proceeds from Athalia's estate. Jinx explained on the stand that he and Athalia had both changed their wills to split evenly with both families. But it didn't matter. Testimony from the dead woman's sister definitely started the seeds of reasonable doubt, or at least gave an excuse for them. As for the murder weapon and other bloody items found by Dewey Lee, Arnold tried to pin those on Dewey Lee himself, saying he could have been the murderer, and even insinuating that the evidence was planted. And unfortunately, Dewey was an alcoholic and was not a polished witness on the stand. In contrast with Alan Stanford's composed testimony in his own defense, the man did not come off as credible. Well, at least not to this jury. The prosecution did score some points, though. The blood type found on the murder weapon and clothes did match Athalia's, and the hair on the machete was consistent with her hair, though even today, people find hair analysis to not be reliable unless there is enough for a DNA match, which, of course, there was no DNA in 1974. In closing arguments, Walter Arnold was just more congenial than the prosecution. He had a more soothing manner, and it didn't hurt that the jury he was talking to was already sympathetic to Alan Stanford. Despite Athalia's efforts at exposing his incompetence, the social class that the Stanfords belonged to were willing to overlook these minor problems in comparison to the animosity felt towards Athalia Ponsell Lindsley. And Walter Arnold did his damnedest to paint Athalia as a deranged woman with a ridiculous vendetta against this fine, upstanding civil servant, Alan Stanford. Assistant DA Stephen Boyles took over closing arguments for the prosecution and said, quote, "Athalia Ponsell Lindsley had the right to live no matter how much she antagonized Stanford. She was a strong-willed woman, exercising her right to free speech when she attacked his credentials. Nobody deserved what she got." Indeed. But it didn't matter. The insular community of St. John's and St. Augustine had made up their minds. Alan Stanford was acquitted. Not long after, the sheriff announced that his office would be closing the case because, quote, "to continue would be to prosecute an innocent person." They knew. I'll say it again. With as few resources as the city police and county sheriff's department had, they did an incredible job, and they ignored community bias. They went against the grain. But in the end, it just didn't matter. Despite its rich history and international fame, St. Augustine is a small city and in the 70s only had about 12,000 residents. Elizabeth Randall had another excellent point in her book on the murder when she said there was no old guard, new guard situation in St. Augustine like there were in other southern cities after the Reconstruction era of the Civil War. Many cities and towns had families who could trace their roots back to the Revolution, and they were the old guard. The new guard were those that came after the war. They weren't exactly welcomed, and towns usually split down the middle on their allegiances. But as Ms. Randall put it, there was no new guard in St. Augustine. There was only the old guard in the old city. And the old guard didn't like outspoken women questioning the qualifications of one of their own. Even though Allen himself was a transplant, he was from Atlanta. He went to Clemson. His wife came from a wealthy, established Southern family. They had the right pedigree, the right looks, and they wanted to fit in. Athalia Ponsell Lindsley was a force to be reckoned with most of her life. From her days on the society pages in New York City to her later years when she became so involved in the Jacksonville community. I think she came to St. Augustine expecting the same respectful reception. Even in death, she was not accorded public respect. The worst of the St. Augustine Record headlines was, "Obnoxious victim had no shortage of possible killers." Which, as shameful as it is to victim blame, the headline is also patently untrue. Athalia only had one true enemy, and that was Allen Stanford, and he had most of St. Augustine, including a powerful church, behind him. But Athalia Ponsell Lindsley was the opposite. She arrived there as a single woman who never had children. She was an intellectual, outspoken, and feisty. She stood her ground with bullies. She did not retreat meekly. In men, all these qualities make you a genius. But if you're a woman, you're an inconvenience. Those are the words from a feminist poem by the singer Halsey. And I think it perfectly sums up Athalia Ponsell Lindsley. She really behaved more like a man of that time than a docile woman. She just didn't give a damn if her neighbors liked her or not, though I'm sure it did sting a bit in the beginning. And while many view her vendetta on Allen Stanford as a petty neighbor's feud, Athalia was not wrong about him. All of her accusations were true, and many people agreed with her, just not the right people in St. Augustine. They would rather set a vicious murderer free than admit Athalia was right. To them, she simply was an inconvenient woman. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Special thanks to Elizabeth Randall, author of Murder in St. Augustine, The Mysterious Death of Athalia Ponsell Lindsley. Her book is available on Amazon in print and Kindle. I'll link it in my show notes. And thank you to listener Chadwick, who suggested this interesting case. And I hope you'll check out my friend Nina's incredible long-form podcast, Don't Talk to Strangers. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. You can also listen directly from Spreaker, my network online, or on their app. And I'm also on Stitcher, CastBox, and many other podcatchers. If you're interested in supporting the show, I have a Patreon page with many different rewards for different levels of donation. Or you can visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, where you can make a one-time donation just by hitting the donate button. I also have a merchandise store open. Just go to whatamaneuver.net and click on Shop by Store, then search for Southern Fried True Crime. I have all sorts of t-shirts, tanks, hoodies, and even onesies for babies. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I'm also all over social media. Just search the show name in your favorite platform if you'd like to connect with me there. If you're interested in discussing Athalia's case or any other episodes further, come check out my discussion group. It is linked to my main Southern Fried True Crime Facebook page. I would love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.